little bit late, but I know you got your stuff together, right? All right.
We'll have you out of here on time or before.
We were going to start. We were going to start without. We knew we had.
Technical setup here.
Are we on? Hello, hello.
Hear me now. Can you hear me now?
Pretty, kind of weak. Kind of low.
Can you hear me now? One, two, three. How, can you hear
How's
me in the back,
sound?
Back there?
Not very well.
Not very well. Just a little bit.
How about now?
How about now?
Nope.
Can you hear me now?
A little more better.
A little bit more. A little bit more.
Think.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
That sounds good. Yeah. Okay. That way I can sit back. So with that, take it away.
Thank you, Commissioners, County Administrator McCauley. I'm Don Benton. I'm the Director of the Department of Environmental Services, and our department is responsible for the NPDES permit, which is issued every 5 years in five-year periods. You may recall, it's been, Ron and I were talking this morning, we were amazed at how fast the time went, but it was a year since we met with you, laid out our plan, the new permit cycle, the 2013-2018 permit cycle, in this room a year ago. And we have been diligently working towards that goal of achieving that permit and getting Ecology to sign off on that, and that that is coming up. So something's popping. We have made tremendous progress, and we still have a few steps to take, but here today we'll update you on our progress, the hard work that our staff has been doing to put all of this together over the last year. And it's a very comprehensive report. I've reviewed it, and I'm very pleased with what you're about to see. And will be available, of course. Rod Swanson is our compliance manager.
Don, can you mute your mic for a minute? We got to get rid of that noise.
Push together. Well, you assume it's my mic.
Can you use the other one?
It's off.
Executive decision.
I didn't really need a microphone because I was finished. So
why don't you start again?
I'm gonna turn it over to Ron Waringa, who's our program manager for clean water, and he's gonna bring you up to speed on what we've been doing and what the next steps are, and answer any questions that you may have along the way. Ron.
Thank you, Don, and thank you, Commissioners, for this opportunity to give you an update on where we are with our rewriting our stormwater code and our design manual. What we want to cover today, just reviewing the work session, provide a little bit of background that we talked about a year ago when we met with you, just some reminders about why we're doing what we're doing, talk about schedule up front, just to let you know what we have to do over the next few weeks and then the next following year. Talk about the status of our current drafts that we've been working on, a high-level summary of what the most significant changes to the code and manual will be, and what we've been doing to reach out to the public and involve stakeholders in this process. And then lastly, when we review the schedule, you'll see we're rapidly approaching a deadline in June to submit our draft code and design manual to Ecology for their equivalency review. So we'll be looking for your authorization today for Director Benton to certify the submittal to Ecology in June. But that's what we're trying to cover.
Ron, as you go forward with the code and the manual background, does that include some of the redesigning of our stormwater facilities?
Not necessarily. I mean, it is part of the permit for sure, Commissioner, but it isn't part of this particular requirement we're talking about today.
All right. Thank you.
This was a slide we presented a year ago, but I wanted to cover it again because I think it's important. It starts out pointing out that we're trying to meet both federal and state regulations with the Clean Water Act and also the state's water pollution control law. The state of Department of Ecology issues us a municipal stormwater permit. The primary county authority is the board, as well as the county administrator, and then internally that responsibility is delegated to the Environmental Services Department to handle. And we don't really do that in a vacuum. We have through our clean water program, we have a pretty small staff. We work very closely with community development, community planning, public works, other departments, as well as partner agencies to make sure that we implement the permit. So that's just sort of who's involved. Another slide that we showed a year ago was some of the changes as a result of the new permit in general. As we said before, nothing really ever goes away in the permit. Whenever we get a new permit, there's more to do. I mean, that's by design. So the areas, all the boxes sort of to the left side of the diagram that are a little bit blackened out, those are all things that we're continuing to do at near the same or a little bit higher level as a result of the new permit that was issued to us in 2013. The most significant changes in the permit are the boxes that are highlighted in terms of planning and some public education and outreach as a result of that planning. And those are the things that we're working on now and going to talk to you today about. Again, updating our design manual, doing a review of all development codes for barriers to low ID and to low impact development, and doing watershed scale planning. So that's what we're going to talk about today, those major things.
Before we get too far from there, the things that you had on the right, these are things that we do on our own as we improve the water quality in Clark County. And the more of the things on the left are more of the mandated things that comes from the state and the federal.
Those, Commissioner, are all mandated things. All of the boxes up there, the ones that are highlighted were the most significant changes in the permit that we were issued in 2013. But everything that we do up there is required by the permit.
So the education outreach, it's mandated, but we still control that.
We do.
At what level we do.
Yes.
And the same with the planning. Our planning has to be accepted by the state, but we still do the insert of that.
I'd say that's definitely true for public education and outreach, so we can control what outreach we do and the level. The planning items that are listed up there are very prescriptive, and I would say the ball's more in the state's court on that one.
A lot of the things that we have there, we are the extension of the arm of the state, and a lot of things are somewhat flexible in some areas more than others, but it gives us some flexibility to do. What I'm thinking is that as we continue down the road and bring our budget back into play, that we recognize those things that are flexible.
Absolutely.
And I assume that those two highlighted boxes are additional mandates that the state has put upon us, but they haven't provided any means to fund that. It's an unfunded mandate, and they're expecting us to come up with new funding provided by our clean water fees in order to fill in those boxes with dollars, right?
That's correct. And under the planning box up there, everything in there is brand new. We weren't doing that in the last permit.
Let me just ask, sorry, Ron. And by the way, that additional planning box, that's a significant cost driver. It's going to require a tremendous amount of resources to do what they want us to do.
So when we met a year ago, we talked to the board about a vision and mission and some goals for this particular project of updating our code and manual. And again, just to remind folks of that, you know, our vision is having that the runoff in the county is managed to protect the vitality of our waterways while supporting an economically and vibrant and livable community. In order to do that, we wanted to create stormwater management regulations that comply with the state and federal regulations while being flexible and tailored, to paraphrase, wherever we can do that in making low-impact development the approach for stormwater management. Our permit actually requires that. In specific goals, one, first and foremost, we wanted to make sure that we would set out to adopt regulations that comply with our permit. That was the most important thing to start with, and also to meet permit deadlines, which we said are relatively tight. We've been doing this for about 15 months now, and we actually had to start on this requirement during the last permit, but in order to get a draft to Ecology by next month for their review, we've really needed to put all hands on deck. So those are tight permit deadlines, and we set out to meet them. And then also to develop an integrated set of development codes, meaning we weren't going to develop new stormwater code and a design manual in a vacuum. We needed to make sure that it fit in with all of the other elements of Title 40 and the other things that applicants and developers are trying to do on their property and try and minimize conflicts wherever we can. So we wanted it to try and work all together.
That was kind of crossed my mind when I see what I see and the new regulation that we all stormwater has to be dealt with on the land that's there. If we take that to the point of being real, real strict with that and none of the water could run off there, would we run the risk of drying up our creeks, ditches, and rivers?
It's definitely a consideration, and that's something that applicants need to look at when they're doing their designs, Commissioner, particularly when it comes to wetlands. They are directed that if there is flow from the site going to wetlands now, they need to be mindful of
that. That's really a hard balancing thing that we have to deal with.
It's definitely a consideration in design. It's a good point. We also want to try and find opportunities to tailor LID feasibility, and we'll get into that in a couple slides, but try and find every opportunity we can to make sure that people have some fair tests to determine whether they have to do a particular practice on site. I'll mention there aren't a lot of opportunities to tailor the feasibility criteria. Those are given to us by the state, but we are exploring those for sure. Go ahead, Commissioner.
A quick feedback. The work session that we had just prior to this one, we were looking at a number that would of how many extra, what percentage of acreage do we need to add for any particular lot development. And the comment that was that prevailed there was that the stormwater treatment is becoming requiring less and less land, so we don't need to set so much aside because there's smarter ways to handle stormwater runoff. Is that the case?
You know, I've had discussions about that because I know that issue has come up. I don't think at this point I could say whether it's requiring more or less land. I think that the things that we're building in for more and better tools for on-site stormwater management provide opportunities to have to dedicate less land for public infrastructure, but kind of on a case-by-case basis, I think we need to look at some examples of and some real data as to how we stack up to the current model assumptions. Kind of just getting into one of the things, the high-level discussion of what we're trying to do. Basically, in updating our stormwater rules, which again is our code and design manual, our task in the permit is to incorporate Ecology's minimum requirements for development projects and do that into our code and design manual. There are 9 minimum requirements. There are things like control sediment from your site or treat runoff or control runoff, on-site stormwater management. We won't list them all. And the requirement is that whatever we have in our code and design manual, the minimum requirements be equivalent to what is in Ecology's 2012 stormwater management manual for the state. That means we need to use the same thresholds for projects, how much impervious area before they have to do which particular things, utilize the same best management practices for treating and controlling runoff, which is the same tools in the toolbox, and meet the same design standards, and that's controlling on-site and then controlling runoff that runs off the site to the state standard. So that's what we're trying to do. Just to mention on this last slide, we didn't think that we could do this in an effective way that would provide a good tool for our applicants or our developers or property owners with our existing design manual. We felt we really needed to create a new manual in order to make all these significant changes, and that's what we set out to do. It was a significant effort, but I think we made a huge leap forward going down the road. I want to touch on project schedule because this is important. There are generally 2 phases of the project that we're working on. One is preparing the draft code and manual. for Ecology's review. And that's this portion in here, this bar that we started last year that brings us up to about where we are now. And then as we go forward, we have to submit it to Ecology for their review, and that's these boxes here. You know, we just finished a public review of the draft. It was a comment period. We incorporated over 250 comments or received over 250 comments. So we'll be taking a look at those. We need to finalize the draft that we're going to submit, and we actually need to submit it to Ecology. The second phase of the project, I'm fully confident that Ecology will take a look at our manual and say if we're not already there, we're really close to equivalency. And if that's the case, then it really leaves us, it gives us time until near next year, near middle of next year, to really fine-tune the document to address some of the broader policy issues that have been brought up throughout the process that we need to discuss with the board and with our advisory groups, and to really fine-tune some of the processes, the internal processes, that make sure that we're ready to receive applications and review projects against our code, and that's internal and external training over the year before we get to middle of June 2015, when the code manual needs to be adopted and made effective by the board.
How real are we treating the feedback for that from the public review of documents or the feedback that we get? And they provided comments. Do we really pay attention to that? And do we factor that in? Because I've seen this kind of process happen on lots of other things. And so we went through all these meetings and all this stuff, and they threw it away at the end, and they just got through the process to say they put it on a shelf somewhere. Does that feedback really help guide this process?
The feedback that we've received from the DEEB, from the Clean Water Commission, and the advisory commission and the advisory committees that we've formed for this project has been invaluable. We would not be anywhere near where we are today if we weren't getting the help from the people that are helping us put this together.
Those voices matter.
Absolutely.
Those are voices that are more in tune to understanding what we're mandated to do. The general public that gives comment is probably not aware of the mandates and what we're required to do. So it's probably the comment you get from the general public would probably be somewhat negative, because it, you know, intrudes upon their rights on the property owner. So I guess that's part of the education and outreach that we try to do too. So as we do that and we talk about things that will help our environment, a lot of it needs to be shared back with part of regulated at the state or federal level, so people understand we just didn't do that.
Right.
Let me just add. Development Engineering Advisory Board, stakeholders advisory committee, technical advisory committee. These are all folks that are pretty much in tune with the process, and their feedback has been, as Ron has said, invaluable. We do get feedback from people about requirements from Ecology that we really can't change. There's nothing we can do about that. We might want to take a different approach, and we've done some of that, and we'll see if Ecology thinks that's equivalent when we submit our manual. We think it will be. So we've tried some equivalencies, but there are some things that we just, I mean, based on Ron's experience and our previous dealings with the Department of Ecology, they're just, you can't change it. That's their rule, and that's just the way it's going to be. But we do try to accommodate, you know, and figure in all of those comments as we move forward.
So let's talk about the most significant change, you know, in my opinion. There are relatively minor changes to the entirety of the 9 minimum requirements that we have to incorporate. The biggest change is in on-site stormwater management. That is the one that basically says property owners and applicants need to control runoff on-site to the extent feasible. And that's essentially the low impact development practices that are required where feasible to infiltrate, disperse, and retain runoff on site. So that sort of sets a bar that's a little tough to define, and we'll talk about what feasibility means in a minute. But that's the main change. It seems like a relatively small change to one of the minimum requirements, but it affects all the other ones. So it's really sort of entry point for and has ripple effects elsewhere. So that's what we really set out sitting on
things
to do.
It reminds me of the different mandates and the things that we've done. I can remember back when we used to send everything out to the street.
Yeah.
And then after that, we said, no, we don't want it in the street. Now we want it on your lawn. Now we said, we want it on your lawn. We don't want it to run off the lawn. So it's been a moving target along the way.
Yep.
My house is still one of those that is designed to take it off the property, and it runs into a seasonal creek.
Yeah.
And it's hard. I can't change that. That's where my downspouts go, so I don't know how to address that other than maybe put in rain barrels, maybe. It depends if the state gets real strict on telling me I can't take their water. So.
Right. Yes,
That on-site, I assume there you're talking about the property line of a lot.
Yes.
Versus regional treatment. Let's say if they're going to put in a subdivision, or they're going to put in a road, that impervious surface needs to be accommodated. So they're going to build some kind of facility there that potentially, if that development area around there, they could potentially plumb to that and use that regional facility. Is that accommodated by these regulations, or is that considered on-site, or because it's a planned development?
I'll say just sort of at a higher level, I don't think any of this precludes regional stormwater management, because the requirement to manage runoff on site will in many cases, I'll say, still result in runoff from the site, because they just have to do it to the extent feasible. So it may not be feasible to manage the runoff at the levels that people need to manage, which are those sort of lower, those frequent but low intensity storms. May not be able to do that on site, and runoff will still be generated. That doesn't mean we just ignore the runoff when it's generated from those high flow events. We're still required to treat and control that runoff, and I think regional stormwater systems are a good way to go about doing that. So it's still on the table. So in order to incorporate low-impact development practices, where feasible, there's a couple of options that we're given and that applicants will have. One is to not use a model, but choose low-impact development practices from a list. So if you have so this is one of the lists. There's a couple lists that we're required to incorporate. But one of the lists, mostly for small projects like a single-family residential project, you need to go through and use these tools in your toolbox, which these are all on-site stormwater management tools for these particular areas. So for lawn and landscape areas, you need to do post-construction soil quality and depth. We're doing that now. That's required now. For roof runoff, you need to go through these options in this order. So you can look at dispersing runoff from your roof first. If you can't meet the dispersion requirements, you look at rain gardens or bioretention, which is a large rain garden, or permeable pavement. If those aren't feasible on your site, you just go down the list and apply what you can or what's feasible. That's using, and then it's different for other hard surfaces like driveways and patios and things like that. But for small projects, you can use this list approach, and we've incorporated that into our manual. You can also use a more complicated approach, but a more flexible approach, and that is Department of Ecology developed a performance standard for matching those lower flow runoff events from your site. This is pretty much the same approach as doing high flow runoff events. And so if you have an engineer and you can run the model, then you can demonstrate that you're doing everything to the extent feasible taking that route.
So it says match. Are we trying to... certainly we get it that we don't want to have extra peak flows coming out of a property, but can you go too much in the wrong direction, retain too much, and then off too slowly? Or are they trying to just simply match it? Are these minimums or are these matched?
You know, if you're doing the modeling approach, it's mainly matching runoff from your site. So if you hold all the water on site, then you're meeting the performance standard. You can't really go above it.
So it's a maximum threshold.
It is essentially a maximum threshold. You know, I think from a what would be considered a technical or scientific, but I also think in part a philosophical perspective is, you know, is infiltrating all of the runoff on a site, if there is some runoff now, the best thing going forward? I don't think we really know yet, to be honest, but that's what the permit requires.
Is that what the 8% is?
Yeah, it's that's the low flow performance standard, Commissioner. It's you look at the 2-year peak flow from the site and under a historic pre-development condition, and you have to match the flow rates from 8% to 50% of the 2-year flow. That's as simple as I can describe it.
Question: How much can run off my property? 0 or 8% or 50% over 2 years?
If you're meeting the performance standard, 8% of the 2-year peak flow from 50% of the 2-year peak flow, the runoff from your property needs to stay underneath that line. So that much. I mean, it just depends on the property. So those are the two approaches this is available for both large and small projects, but I suspect the smaller projects will mostly use the list approach. So just sort of looking at that visually, small projects such as single-family residential, you know, soil quality and depth and landscaped areas, roofs, you got to look at dispersion and infiltration. Those are some rain gardens or infiltration through residential drywells on a site. Those all work. And then for other hard surfaces, driveways and patios, you know, you have options of permeable pavers, rain gardens, and dispersion. And, you know, if you can do that, you have to just running it off, you know, from your downspout onto your property there. There are some design criteria for dispersion that you need to meet. You can't just run it off into your neighbor's property, for example. So that's sort of a visual of how people will start using these tools on small projects. For larger projects, you know, taking an example of like a commercial or industrial site plan, they also have an option to choose from a list. It's a similar list. It's only slightly different in that permeable pavement has to be used first, and then rain gardens and other methods after that. But they can also use the performance standard again, which we talked about. Most, I think, will for larger projects, which is more flexible in which BMPs can be used, including traditional BMPs, things, you know, like drywells, things like, you know, ponds. If you can show you're meeting the standard with traditional BMPs, then you're allowed to do that. So I think with that flexibility, most people will choose that approach. People often ask at this point in the conversation about how do we know what's feasible. So, you know, really the state tells us that. There are four the on-site practices that we're allowed to use. Each of those practices, like in that list, for example, have infeasibility criteria that the state has developed. They're basically yes or no questions that people can ask about their site. And if they can't, you know, if they determine that it's not feasible to use on their site and they have to have, you know, documentation and submit that with their application, then they don't have to use it. So that's where, you know, controlling runoff using on-site stormwater management to the extent feasible is essentially with those yes or no questions. An example for the feasibility would be, you know, if they don't have to use a particular BMP if it's not feasible, and so for permeable pavement, it's not feasible in high traffic areas, you know, on fill soils, on bridges, which is a good thing, and where there's high groundwater. So you don't, if you have these conditions on your site, or if you can check these boxes, then you don't have to use permeable pavement on your site, and you move on. There was it was in this area that we look to try and tailor some of those feasibility requirements to our conditions. Some of the infiltration testing, some of the soil conditions. We had a comment during the comment period that we should look at trying to bring in some economic feasibility criteria. That's something that we need to see whether or not we can do. But this is where we'll continue to try and fine-tune and see if we can add some flexibility in this feasibility determination. You know, this is sort of, my opining slide, but the net result of these new on-site requirements, one, I think this is a positive. It adopts new requirements, but more importantly, practices for managing runoff on-site. We didn't have some of these tools in our old design manual. People need these tools. They're building these into these projects. A lot of the engineers we talk to say, you know, we're already using low-impact development where we can because it makes more sense and it saves money. So that's a good thing. I think that, you know, creating tools for people to use, that's good. In general, though, it's a disincentive for site clearing and adding new hard surfaces. In other words, if you clear your site from line to line and you add a significant amount of new hard surface, it could cost you more. It could be more difficult to get it approved and construct. And then also, you know, because of the fact that runoff treatment and flow control for those higher flows is still required, it can make it even more challenging by adding hard surfaces as well. We wanted to make a note on some of these items were appealed to the Pollution Control Hearings Board. The ruling has come out, and they did change or remanded back to Ecology to change some of the feasibility criteria for permeable pavement. Should generally limit its application. For example, they said only for very low traffic volumes. Ecology has not come out yet with guidance on how to incorporate the Pollution Control Hearings Board ruling. The last time I spoke with our permit manager, the guidance we got was to just put something in your manual knowing it'll probably change. So what we have in there now is essentially what was in the state's manual. But there, right now we don't know what the net effect of the Pollution Control Hearings Board ruling will be, but it will change the feasibility requirements for permeable pavement.
No connection between that hearings board and the Department of Ecology? They're two separate entities. I would think that naturally the Department of Ecology would be the ones, unless the hearings board is supposed to incorporate business and economics and practical applications. Is that why it's separate?
I'm not really sure why it's separate. I know that in this particular case, they relied on Ecology's expertise pretty much throughout their ruling.
The hearings board's role is to just go back and make sure what you put there matches the state or federal law. It probably become less flexible because they follow the letter of the law. It's like blessing Department of Ecology, I guess.
Sometimes. I mean, we found the last time we were there when Ecology was agreeing with us, they didn't rely on Ecology's expertise. So sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. This is another question we often get, is that how are current projects affected? So this is important to highlight. This is dictated by our permit. So as we said, we have to have the code and manual adopted and made effective by July 1st, 2015. The permit says that the new requirements will apply to all project applications submitted after July 1, 2015. We've had some discussion internally, and I'll continue to work with Marty and others about defining. We need to define what a project application is. I think that's something for us to do. But practically and procedurally going forward, we need to have a clear definition of what these new rules apply to. Generally, the permit says applications submitted after they become effective. For projects that have already submitted applications or received final engineering approval, the permit says that construction needs to start by July 1, 2020, or these new requirements apply to that project. Again, I think we have to define what this means. There was a particular concern, and I thought a healthy discussion when we went to the Development Engineering Advisory Board about phased projects, and that's a really good question. I don't think we have an answer to that. At the moment about what about phase projects, but we need to define that. It's really important that we do. But that's generally when this stuff hits the ground. Public outreach summary to date, you know, we touched on this a little earlier, but we had a technical and a stakeholder advisory committee. We had 8 meetings with the technical advisory committee, tremendous input from those folks and stakeholders. We had 5 meetings, again, just really sort of higher level policy discussions, sounding board type discussions. I thought it went well. Internal stakeholders, you know, 3 departments, multiple divisions. Marty Snell and Heath Henderson and Oliver, all of their staff have been tremendously helpful in working with us on this particular project. I think Jane Kleiner had told me a couple weeks ago that we'd had over 70 meetings internally with people, and so everyone's really helped us do this. It's much appreciated. And then we did a public review. We publish monthly newsletters, email updates to a stakeholder distribution list. We have a website dedicated to this. We did a media release when we released our draft and also put it out for this comment period. You know, I think even though we're ready to submit our draft, we're still a little early in the process. I think people will, again, start paying more attention once we get closer, and we'll probably start hearing things that we haven't heard before. So over this next year, you know, we'll continue this public input process, which I think has been going pretty well. We just need to get the word out a little bit more.
So as this gets developed, it gets published on the website. What is that address?
It's on the last slide.
That's good enough.
Yeah, okay. So I don't have that memorized. I'll work on that. So the next steps. Our goal is to finish this draft code and manual by mid-June. Our contractor that's working on it will have it to us by June 1. If we don't have to make any changes, then we won't. But regardless, for us, it's pencils down by mid-June because we need to get it submitted to the state. We'll submit to Ecology for their equivalency review. They have, Rod, is it 90 days? Are undefined.
It's either 60 or 90. I think it's 90.
They have 60 to 90 days to review this document that we'll be submitting. This is our new manual. It's about 1,000 pages. So it'll probably take them most of that 90 days to do it. In the interim, and then continuing from there, we'll continue to refine process-related items like submittals, policies, prepared final code for board adoption. We'll have public hearings, probably more than one, and put it before the board for adoption. We're shooting for around March. Again, it needs to be adopted and made effective by the end of June. So that's entirely flexible, but giving people a little bit of advance warning and making it, you know, even if we hypothetically adopted it in March, it wouldn't be effective until what's required in the permit. But that's what we're shooting for. We can fine-tune that. And then again, making it effective by June 30, that's what we need to do. At www.clark.wa.gov under stormwater, you'll find the link to this code and manual update project. And then also a few other things you might be able to find about low impact development and some of the other things we do are also on that website. And that is the update that we're hoping to provide. At this point, discussion, comments, questions, we'd be happy to talk about them.
Very thorough. Any questions from the audience? I told you it was pretty thorough. Comment. I know that mic there.
So I participated in quite a bit of the process. I was on the PAC, had quite a few meetings just with staff, submitted quite a few comments. I have to say, you know, staff's done an amazing job within the constraints that they had. There's still significant issues with the permit, but that's kind of outside our control. You know, things like unreasonable targets, ignorance of competing needs, and a lot of unfunded mandates, which we're going to all have to deal with. But through the process, the way staff handled it, we're all kind of in it together. We're all trying to find solutions to the problem and work with the constraints.
Okay, there we go.
Start over now.
Could you hear it all right?
I heard you.
Okay, sounds good. But we did, we provided a significant, I provided quite a few comments. I'd like to see some of those included. I think staff's working through those now. And all those comments, we believe, are will be found to be compliant. A lot of them just add clarification and fill in blanks where the existing manual is not clear. One thing that did come up, you guys asked a question, which I had kind of an answer for, and it was about the comment that with the new comp plan, that the new stormwater facilities will take less land. I think there's a different approach because there's a lot of different situations. I kind of put projects in three different categories. There's projects in well-drained soil, projects in moderately drained soil, and then poorly drained. So when we're looking at the comp plan and figuring out what land's necessary for infrastructure, you can take the well-drained soils and basically say, hardly any new with this permit. It's almost zero impact. You're going to be able to do it within the right-of-way. From the old method to the new method, about the same. In moderately drained soils, our rule of thumb, when we do a feasibility, that's one of the first things we look at. We look at, I have a map that I use. It was put together by ASCE with the county participation. And we kind of have a green, red, and orange, basically. You can look at where you are, and you kind of know what you're your approaches for stormwater and how much of a site you're going to lose to stormwater. In moderately drained soils, kind of rule of thumb, 10 to 20% of your site, you're going to be able to deal with, you're going to have to use LID to hit that the new flow control standard, those previously unregulated storms. You'll be able to do that most likely in your right-of-way and without any additional, but you still have to deal with traditional. So 10 to 20% of your site in those situations are going to go to stormwater. Then you have a situation where you have poorly drained soils, and you're looking at sometimes 30 to 40%. And in those situations, when we're looking at those areas in the county and adding those and what percentage is going to be infrastructure, I think we need to correlate that to those maps and expectations. And it's not a simple, you know, here's our factor. Here's our area. So you take that area, you kind of do a weighted average, that area times that factor, and that's going to be the amount of area we're going to need to do the same growth.
I'm curious if our GIS map shows those soil drainage colors so that as we lay out what parcels we're going to be zoning for business, for instance, that we can accommodate that extra land that's necessary and maybe less areas where it drains better.
Yeah.
Do we know, is the GIS map updated with that across the areas we need?
Through ASC, which is American Society of Civil Engineers, a local chapter, we work closely with county and the GIS map, and it was actually put together through GIS, so I'm sure it's available, and it's something that would be pretty easy to reference. It's a little more work on that, but it's the areas are pretty easy to figure out. They're pretty contiguous.
So can site by site be considered? I think back when I put a pole barn in, and there's a third of my holes that didn't drain, and the others drained completely. So is that considered when you do something like that, if you was to divert your water toward an area that you actually tested that soil for being permeable?
Sounds like your site is in that second category of moderately draining, where it's not gravel underneath, but you'll have some impact. With these new regulations, I'm not sure exactly where you are for your pole barn, but it sounds like from the soils you're hitting, you're moderately draining. You have some where you can get rid of them. There's also areas where it's depth dependent, and we have these alluvial flood deposits, and if you go down far enough, you're probably going to hit something that drains.
Well, these are like 4-foot holes, you know, for putting the poles in the ground. So.
And that's a good point. You know, when Department of Ecology was writing these regulations, they were basing it on the soil types you get in Puget Sound. So you're looking at pervious pavement might be feasible in certain soil types up there because they're pretty consistent by layer. You get kind of either really well draining or really poorly. Here, we might have 8 feet of silt and clay, and then underneath we have great draining soil. So if you're trying to apply this, the feasibility criteria that the developer Puget Sound, the soil type you punch in the model, looks like you can get rid of your stormwater. But try to do pervious pavement where the upper 8 feet is clay and silt. It doesn't work. In those cases, you want to do more traditional methods where you get down to those layers. You have to concentrate it to get it down there because you're not going to open up 8 feet of your soil and fill it all in with rock. It's just not cost effective. So we do have different criteria, and we did address that in the manual, and we're that's stuff that we work with staff to find solutions to.
I can't thank the D board enough. Since its creation, it's been a miracle of relationships, and we solved so many problems. Thank you guys so much. It's been good.
I'm curious, the soil types that's provided in our GIS map, is that the top surface soil? Do we have anything that determines what's down there 6 or 8 feet?
That's a good question, because it's very general, and that layer changes. There's a map. USDA has an old mapping system that shows, based on the soil type, there's general layers, and it tries to define those, but really you need more site-specific geotechnical to find out where that layer is. So it usually says the top surface, and there's an LGB A and B in the soil manual, and the A and B will be your differences in the depth of your top soil versus the lower soil. So there's some guidance, but it's not.
So what it sounds like is that in order for us to get through the process and provide the land for development in these different areas, we can only go by what's really available in our GIS. So it sounds like only the surface is available in our GIS when it comes to the drainage. Even though there's more information we want to dig for, that's not going to be practical for us to be able to factor in to these layouts, it sounds like, because we got to define the map.
And that's what ASCE did. When they did their paper, they looked at other projects in those areas. So where you have like an LGB soil that's a Lauren gravelly loam, in that you're in the type 1, you're well drained, it's not going to be an issue. You're going to have zero impact. It also depends on groundwater. The depth to groundwater, so we have that map as well. I believe with the map we compiled, it's not exact, but it's a lot better than ignoring it altogether. It's the best information available we can base our decision on.
Nothing's exact, get that part. But when we do factor in all the different land, we want to make sure that we turn on those layers so that we can provide the factor that would say, if we need X number of acres with this kind of soil, we need a factor that changes that a little bit. I'm curious also, the tools in the toolbox, are they defined by us so that the economy is included in the sequence that you do, or is that defined by Department of Ecology that leaves out the expense?
Question. That was a good portion of the comments in the appeal, was how the permit ignored economic impact. They didn't take in account the cost, or more importantly, life cycle cost. For example, pervious pavement, while it may not be that much more expensive to put in than traditional pavement, its life cycle and potential for failure significantly higher, and instead of replacing your roads every 20-year life cycle, you might be doing significant changes every 5 years if it plugs up. And then not only that, you can't do overlays. So there's significant impacts in some cases, depending on other, you know.
So must we comply with that exactly as published, or can we, as we provide our plan to them, modify it in a way that says if it passes your tests, this is the way we want to, because this is unique to us, this is our county, and we do need to factor in the economic impact. And if they can bless it, then we're okay.
Let me add to your question, kind of. So it goes back to that. I'm not sure if I got an answer. Can someone come up and do some test boring and come back to the county and said, the map shows I'm in a bad area, but I just tested my whole driveway area, so therefore, do we accept that? Do we acknowledge that? Oh, good.
We require on-site information.
Okay. All right.
Just back to your question. Yes, we, again, our manual will be submitted, and the only reason we do it is because we could have just adopted their manual, but it's primarily based on Puget Sound soils, and so we're submitting one that reflects our area, and it's our hope that Department of Ecology will say, yes, that's the same as our manual, that's essentially complies, and yes, we bless your manual. They'll let us know if they, believe me, if they disagree with some of the areas that we put in there. And that has been a discussion. I will tell you, I attended a conference almost a year ago where a contractor for Department of Ecology was putting on initial training programs, and his comment at the time was that ecology is not and has no plan to consider finance or cost as part of the not feasible description or argument.
Right.
Now, maybe that's changed. I don't know, but we'll see when we submit our manual.
Yes, and I'm glad that there's so much thought about the practical implementation to fulfill the requirements that is really what the Department of Ecology is trying to do. But we want to make sure also we don't repeat that same mistake we did, back in 2011 or so. We would try to implement a different policy that deviated from the standard, got sued, lost, good intentions, bad implementation. So we want to be able to, whatever we end up with, if I assume that if they accept it, that we're good. We're not going to get sued and say, well, no, that doesn't match.
It doesn't always work that way. Remember that last
time. I don't know who we come to, but you got to remember they supported our alternative flow control method when we first went before.
That's right.
So it is appealable. Their decision is appealable.
Real quick. We're over our time real quick.
Yeah, just real quick. I wanted to just address a little bit more of the infeasibility criteria and lay it specifically down to what the Pollution Control Hearings Board specifically said in this case, and I think this was in my comments to the county. Yeah. Specifically, they said that feasibility, this is on page 35 of the opinion, specifically feasibility is measured against, among other things, the infeasibility criteria set forth in the 2012 manual. The Pollution Control Hearings Board, though, did go on to state that infeasibility criteria can be expanded. So this is sort of the genesis of my comment, and I think if you knew the context with which that comment was sort of taken, it was a lot of the testimony that was provided by Eric, Mr. Tuck, and throughout the other jurisdictions about some of the economic consequences that these new techniques are going to require, not only in the short term but in the long term, that it would be fair for the county to submit to Ecology for consideration additional economic and feasibility criteria. And if that point Ecology does agree with that, and I think the hearings board has given them sort of a floor to base that on, legally speaking, and it's accepted, I think it's a way we can have that in the permit and be reasonable with that.
Maybe we could put that in our manual and reference the other board.
That would be my strong suggestion.
Thank you all today. All good information. Thank you, Ron. Thank you, Don. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Thanks for the comments. Yeah.